Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. It is Monday, June 5. So we are underway with our summer months. June, July, August. I always think that's summer. Let's live it up. And I think a lot of schools are already out and others are getting out this week. And what are the kids going to do this summer? Right? Summer jobs? What's going to happen? You got to sleep in for about a week, right? And then you get a summer job and you do something productive.
That seems very reasonable.
Yeah. Now, when you were in high school, Rebecca, I bet you were a big summer reader, weren't you?
Very much so.
Yes.
So you pretty much a continuation of the whole year.
You just never let up, did you?
No, not really. And I did have a job. I mean, when I turned 16, I had my first job at my first radio station.
Oh,
so
very
I
cool.
couldn't read on the job then, but yes. Every other time I had a book in my hand.
And you recently moved, and the biggest complaint from your movers were, "Oh no, not another box of books."
That was exactly what I heard.
I know you did.
And I don't blame them. I mean, to be fair, I may go a little bit overboard with the books, but they took the job. So
yeah, they didn't know what they were getting into. You should have shown them the books.
And here is my library
of books. Anyway, 1 Thessalonians 5, in verse 11, it says, "Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing. Now, we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard and love because of their work. Live in peace with each other." That's the part of the verse I think, don't we need a little bit more of that? Just a little bit encouragement to live in peace with each other. Seems that the world over the weekend, in particular, had so much chaos and hatred and bitterness and anger that we are in a place where, as believers and followers of Christ, we need to be calm, be loving, smile at people, engage with them, listen to them, and try to show them the love of Christ, because Christ has given us peace, so we need to turn around and share it with others.
And I think that in itself makes the difference. I mean, when the world is in chaos, it's difficult because we're in the world to not be caught up in that storm right in the eye of the tornado. But I think what makes the difference in a believer's heart is that we know the source of strength. It doesn't come from us. It's not natural for us. But we go to our God, who is unchanging, who always keeps his promises. We know that he is our source of security. And once we're filled up with that knowledge, then we can spread that and share that with other people who may not know. And that's what makes the difference. It isn't coming from us or our own power. It's coming from the power of our God.
Preach it, sister.
All right. I had a lot of coffee this morning.
So did I. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, some of the source of shame and guilt that we feel really goes back to Genesis chapter 3. Dr. Glenn Pickering is going to tell us about that. Be back in a minute. Good morning and welcome back. You know, I think it says in Psalm 90, "Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love that we may sing for joy and be glad all of our days." I always sing for joy when I get a chance to talk to my next guest, Dr. Glenn Pickering. He is an author and speaker and counselor, and he is at glennpickering.com. It's a website, I think. Is it active or is it still under construction?
I think it's going like live today or tomorrow.
Awesome, awesome. You can reach him there. It's Glenn with two N's. And Glenn, it's always I always like talking to you because your insight is always a little bit different from what I hear, which I love. And
Thank you.
The subject I want to talk about, and we've been sort of talking about this the last couple of weeks, is the biggest cultural fear a lot of people have is shame. And I don't know what all contributes to it. We've had several different opinions on it, but we're trying to figure out a way to deal with this feeling of shame, and that can spiral into all kinds of bad things, can it?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And can I speak to that cultural part just for a second?
Please.
Well, see, I don't think it actually is cultural. I mean, I think it shows up in our culture for sure. But I think, so if you read the story of Adam and Eve, you know, they're in the garden, everything's exactly as it should be, that is exactly as God created it to be. And then the serpent comes along and convinces Eve and then Adam that actually the truth is there's something wrong with them. They don't even know the difference between good and evil, for crying out loud. And they believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with them.
Wow.
So they eat the apple, and then they're ashamed. And when they're ashamed, then, of course, they want to hide themselves. Now, so I think, yeah, we can call that a cultural fear, but I swear to you, it is actually the original sin. We have struggled with this issue from the absolute beginning. Are we going to believe God who says, Glenn, you're precious exactly as I created you? Or am I going to believe the serpent that says, Glenn, really there's something wrong with you?
Hmm. Well, clearly, most all of us feel that there's something wrong with us, which is
I know, part it's
of the
so
fall.
Easy to believe that lie, yes.
But it's right. So true. So when we go into any kind of shame-based place,
right.
We have needs. We withdraw. We try to hide. And that,
right.
of course, creates loneliness, which can also produce all kinds of other dysfunctions as well.
Right.
A word that starts with A, I think it's addictions.
Exactly right. You know me, I always say every addiction is driven by that profound sense of loneliness. When
mm-hmm.
I withdraw because I don't want people to quote-unquote find out that there's something wrong with me, then I get overwhelmed by that loneliness, and I really believe every addiction is driven by that loneliness. It creates a gap in us that's so painful we literally can't live with it. And so it's like if I can just fill up that gap with enough money, drugs, alcohol, sex, prestige, whatever it is I'm thinking that's going to make me feel better, oh boy, then we're on that bad path.
Yeah, Glenn, one of these articles I read talked about how Americans are trying to avoid shame and they want to make their loved ones proud. Has our need for approval changed over the years, and has it always been that? Have we always needed approval, or has it gotten worse?
Well, what I think is the further we get from God's truth that we're precious as we are, and the more we really do embrace that shame-based lie that there's something wrong with us, the more we sort of embrace that lie, the more we're going to think we quote-unquote need approval. Because if I really think there's something wrong with me, then there's a part of me that's just thinking, if I can just get enough people to tell me that I'm okay, that I'm good, then maybe I would finally feel okay about myself. And so I think to the extent that we as a culture fall into that very, very old sin of believing there's something wrong with us, the more people are going to feel like they, quote-unquote, need approval.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, Glenn, this is something that we thought very early on in life, maybe we were told something
right.
and it registered
right.
in our brain that, oh my, there's something wrong with me. And then
right.
we live that out into our adulthood or maybe for the rest of our lives. Can you talk to that?
Right. Yes. I think, you know me, I talk a lot about the game of tag where it's just like in the garden. So Adam and Eve, they make this mistake. And that's all it is. It's just a mistake. They believe the serpent and they eat the apple. And then it says, and they're ashamed of themselves. And, of course, right away, then they want to do two things. First, they want to hide themselves. So they put on fig leaves to hide their body. And then Adam hides behind a tree thinking God's not going to find him. Which, that whole story is just so funny to me. Like,
yeah,
so,
me too.
Here's God, the creator of the entire known universe, but he's not going to know that I'm behind this tree over here.
Uh-huh.
And if that doesn't work, if hiding doesn't work, then when God finally does find them and finds out that they ate the apple, he says to Adam, well, why did you do that? And Adam then, since hiding is no longer working, goes into blame where he says, well, you know, the woman that you gave me told me to eat the apple. So God, is either your fault or it's her fault, but it's just for sure not mine. And we get that message all the time then growing up. Instead of hearing from people who are trying to help us, instead of hearing the message that we made a mistake, we hear the message that there's something wrong with us because kids are very literal thinkers. They're very black and white, very concrete. So a lot of times if we're trying to teach them or discipline them or help them do things differently, the message that comes through to them is not, hey, there's a better way to do this, or hey, that's a mistake and you need to learn something. The message they get is you're bad. Or there's something wrong with you.
Mm.
And boy, do kids internalize that message. And then you're right. We can literally live out that message the rest of our life if we're not careful.
And then, Glenn, as an adult, when you are in an adult conversation and you feel maybe threatened by something somebody's saying, you might
right.
be hearing it through the ears of a 7-year-old.
Right, exactly. A very small person who then hears, oh, my gosh, they think there's something wrong with me. And if I am still kind of that little 7-year-old, which on some level we all are, then I don't just think, oh, my gosh, they think there's something wrong with me. We think, oh, they have discovered the truth, which is that there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because deep down we believe that lie, that satanic lie, that there is something wrong with us.
Mm-hmm. So if we really want to study and figure out what the enemy's plan is, we just look at God's truths and his promises and then just reverse them.
Exactly. So God says, no, Glenn, you're precious in my sight. I love you with a steadfast love. You are exactly as I created you to be.
And or if we look, Glenn, at Jesus saying, I will never leave you or forsake you, and
right,
you think,
exactly,
well, what Satan will say is you're worthless, you're going to end up alone, and no one's going to love you.
Right, unless you put on a mask that's so good that you're perfect for loving you.
Yeah. All right, Glenn.
Right.
That's
what approval is, right?
Yeah. We're going to continue this conversation talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering, and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. We're having a lively conversation this morning with Dr. Glenn Pickering. He's an author, a teacher, a pastor, an engineer. He's done everything but run off and join the circus. So, and of course, I don't know, that could happen today. But we're talking today about this culture of shame. And Glenn, I thought it was so interesting that you said, no, that's been hardwired into us since the beginning. When sin entered the world, that there's something wrong with us. I thought that was a great point. But when we're talking about trying to have a sense of balance in our life, and I know that's a buzzword, and I was talking earlier with a guest about the word perfection, how we use that in conversation. We obviously have a desire to be approved, and we want people to like us. But then when things go wrong, we go, oh, I'm not perfect.
Right, exactly. And here, well, let me say two things about that, if that's okay.
Please.
One, so then we settle for approval because we think there's something wrong with us. We believe that lie. And so we think, okay, if I can just get enough people to approve of me, then I would feel okay. If enough people on the outside say, Glenn, you're really great, then maybe on the inside I'd start feeling like I was great. But here's the really, really just wicked thing about thinking I need approval. So I put on this mask that I talked about before break. So I pretend to be the person I think they want me to be.
Okay.
So that they will approve of me. Now, because then that will make me feel better about myself. But here's the absolute wicked lie about that. If I pretend to be somebody I'm not, just to get your approval, then when you pat me on the back and tell me how great I am, it doesn't make me feel better on the inside. The only thing it makes me feel like is, yeah, you say that, but if you knew the real me. And so we do that so we'll finally feel loved, but all it does is make us less loved and feel less loved and more like, I'm only okay if.
Hmm.
If I look a certain way, if I talk a certain way. And honestly then, instead of that thinking we need approval, which we have no such need, we need to be loved. But if I put on that approval mask, love is what never happens to me because love means somebody sees the real me and loves me. But if I have that approval mask on all the time, nobody can love the real me because they don't even get to see the real me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I literally condemn myself to staying on that path and feeling unloved.
Mm-hmm.
Painful.
You know what? It sounds exhausting, too. It sounds absolutely exhausting.
So it's like a treadmill to nowhere. If I can just get more people to approve of me, more people to like me, if I can just wear the right more things or say the better things or get a better job or make more money or look better on the outside somehow, then I'd finally feel better on the inside. But it never works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a search. It's like every addiction. It's a search for an external solution to an internal problem.
Mm-hmm.
If what I really, really believe is I'm not good enough, then there's nothing on the outside that's going to make me think that I am.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, is there a difference when you say that I'm not good enough? Do one of the sexes struggle with that more than the other?
Well, I think, honestly, we both struggle with it so bad. I think it shows up differently.
Okay.
So I think guys tend to focus on performance. If I could just do enough things, if I do well enough on my job or earn enough money or do a good enough job, then I would finally feel better. And women tend to focus on relationships. Like if there are more people who liked me, I would feel better. But they're actually just the same lie. If I could just do X, Y, or Z, then I will be okay. But what Jesus says and what God says over and over and over in the scriptures is, no, you're okay already.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to earn my love. You already have that. I want you to start off with the assumption I already adore you, and then go tell everybody else.
Mm-hmm. So one of the struggles that I, as I'm listening to you, I think, all right, we have God's word. It's the revealed word of God is available to us. It teaches us truth about who we are.
Right.
We want to believe that. We want to take that in. Yet there's something that keeps us from living in that truth all the time. What's up with that?
Right. You know, I honestly think this really does come back. When people talk about the original sin, I think they sort of, I mean, they understand that there is such a thing. I don't know if they get what it actually looks like. It's important to understand when we look back at the story in the garden, that the original sin is not that Adam and Eve ate the apple. The original sin is that they thought they needed to.
Say more, because I'm scratching
they
my head here a little.
They believed the lie that there's something wrong with them.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Okay.
And so because they believed that lie, then they behaved in certain ways, which created shame in their life. So it's important to understand, we struggle with this one because we struggle with this one. It is literally part of the human condition that the absolute fundamental component of our Christian walk is, if I'm really seriously on that walk, what that means is I'm getting better and better and better, living from that place where I know that God already loves me, and less from that place where I believe the lie that I'm only lovable if I do everything right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the world will say you are more lovable if you perform
well.
I know.
That's absolutely. There are lots of things out there that would feed right into that belief. But it's also important to understand, but all that stuff only feeds into the belief because we are already so susceptible to that belief.
Mm-hmm. Now, Glenn, as we talk about shame, shame is obviously something that really is saying there is something wrong with you, whereas guilt
right.
would say you've fallen short somewhere, you have
made a mistake,
you've made a poor
right.
decision, and you can
right.
bring that guilt to the foot of the cross and ask for forgiveness and then reconcile with the person you might have wronged. But shame is that ongoing nagging, there is something wrong with you, and where do I begin?
Right, and here's why that shame then is so satanic and so wicked. God wants me to learn and to grow and mature. Every single thing about being a disciple, being on the path, is about learning, growing, and maturing, which is why I always say, God always says these two things to me, Glenn, I love you exactly as you are, and I insist that you change. So we're always on this path of growing more and more and more. Well, see, if I make a mistake and I, oh, golly, that didn't work very well, what does that teach me? And I learn from my mistake, and in that process, I become a better person, a better man, a better Christian. See, that God's like, hey, great, this is just what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But see, if I'm all shameful and I make a mistake and I just think, oh, Glenn, you're so dumb, you'll never get it right, that's so stupid, what's wrong with you? Not only do I not learn the lesson, I don't even ask myself what the lesson is.
Okay.
Because I'm so busy just condemning myself. But the scriptures are pretty clear. There's no condemnation in Christ. So Christ doesn't condemn us. Christ just wants us to learn from our mistakes. And so over and over and over, I talk with my clients about, okay, so we make mistakes. This is a given. Now, the only question is, okay, are you going to take the godly path where that mistake teaches you something and you become better? Or are you going to take the satanic path where every mistake just triggers for you all that self-hatred and self-shame and you just tell yourself how bad a person you are?
Because
that one's up to us. It's not up to us whether we make mistakes. That's a given. It's up to us what we do with those mistakes.
Yeah. Glenn, we just have a couple of minutes left. And if
yep.
the default position is to hide and withdraw,
right.
that's the default position, how can we learn to open up and confess and to be more transparent?
I honestly believe that every men's group that I go to that's really great, every support group that's really helpful, every accountability group that's useful to people is useful precisely because it's a place where we tell our truth, people hear the truth, and support us in continuing to grow. And so if I go to a Bible study, for example, where all they're going to do is talk about here's what that passage means to me, but nobody's going to talk about their own life and about how this impacts them and what they're learning,
mm-hmm.
that Bible study is of very little use. Same with a men's group, accountability group, etc. But if every group I go to, people are like, hey, Glenn, tell us how this applies to you. where is this working for you? Where are you falling down? And how can we pray for you in this process between now and next time we see you? Now, see, now that actually really helps me get clear. These people love me, and they just want me to keep getting better.
Wow. That's awesome. That's putting a personal application into studying God's Word, which is what we should be doing anyway.
Right, absolutely. And by whether we're reading it ourselves or we're reading it in our Bible study group or our men's groups or women's groups or whatever, we need to always be thinking, how does this apply and how can we support each other in applying it very directly to our lives?
Yeah, and hopefully that website will be up today, your brand-new website, because there's going to be lots of great resources. Glenn's book on TAG is one I've read many, many times. It's a great resource book. And the website is Glenn Pickering, P-I-C-K-E-R-I-N-G, Glenn with two N's, glennpickering.com. Hopefully when that gets active, you'll have access to all of Glenn's materials, and you can get an idea as to his writing and his books. And always, Glenn, it's just a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. Have a great day.
Hey, you
too. All right, thanks. We'll take a short break and be right back. Good morning, Bill Arnold here. Stay hopeful. That's something we all have to do, and it can be tempting to shut down during seasons of change. Dr. Greg Smalley encourages us to stay hopeful and do things that will benefit you and your loved ones.
I love the statement, you can't give what you don't have. And I want to be able to, as I go through this, I want to be full of God's love. I want to have what I need versus, you know, it's easy for me to go into the isolation mode, shutting down, going down into our basement, turning on the TV with a big honking bag of chips, you know, and fighting to not get up in the morning. I love, I'll get up real early, I'll exercise. But you know what? As we go through transition, we might launch into some depression and just not want to do the things that normally helped us to not just to stay healthy and fit, but actually, you know, keeps us out of depression. And so I make myself get up in the morning, even though I'm tired or I don't want to, knowing that the endorphins that are released and just the, you know, getting on the treadmill and what that does to me, it gives me then more to be able to get out to my family.
If you want to hear that full interview, go to MyFaithRadio.com and search Greg Smalley. And it is on stabilizing marriage in stormy times. We'll take a little break, and then when we return, Dr. David Aikman is with us. Can't wait.
Some families let arguments and fighting tear them apart, but in reality, conflict can pull a family together. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. When handled properly, conflict can actually improve relationships. People who stick together through thick and thin become closer by the end. In fact, some of the teens I recall most fondly are the ones who made me want to pull my hair out. Engaging rather than avoiding will teach your teen how to manage conflict well years down the road. The day will come when they have their first fight with a future roommate, employer, or spouse. So don't shy away from conflict with your teen. When it's time to get in there and fight for something you believe in, create a model of resolution they will never forget.
Mark Gregston has prepared a brand new resource to help parents draw their teens closer, not push them away. Download your free copy online at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
It is 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here. I'm going to do a little bit of math. It's, 140 or so in Bray, Ireland, where my guest, Dr. David Aikman, lives. And in 10.5 hours, he's going to be having a birthday. And being the overachiever I am, I want to be one of the first to wish you happy birthday, David.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. That's very thoughtful of you and most unexpected, but delightful.
Well, before we get to the news of the day, since we spoke last, Sir Roger Moore has passed away. And I was wondering, who is your favorite 007?
You know, I have to say Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, really?
I
didn't see that coming.
I thought he brought a sort of smoothness and a wry sense of self-deprecating humor to the role that was, in my view, a little bit closer to the original intention of the character of James Bond. I mean, that's just a personal opinion. I mean, it's almost impossible to fault the original James Bond, whom we all love still in different roles, but and some people are very fond of Daniel Craig, but I thought Pierce Brosnan pulled off a really smooth operation.
All right, now, David, just for me, would you say the line, "My name is Bond, James Bond"? I want to hear it from you.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
I love it. All right, we've got Radio Gold, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. All right, now let's move on to the business of the weekend. Of course, what happened in London on the bridge was just horrific, and chaos is now seems to be the main topic in London today. What is your take on what happened?
Well, I think this is part of a pattern. I mean, this is the third terrorist action in England in 3 months. It was started off by the operation on Westminster Bridge, and then followed by the Manchester bombing, and then on Saturday, or at least on Friday night, the London Bridge operation. And what we're dealing with is a sort of low-tech terrorism, which I think has been correctly identified mm-hmm. by British intelligence as one of the worst developments of the sort of Islamist operation against the West. And I think we are in great danger of seeing several more such attacks. I mean, the rate of the security or the terrorist danger level is now at critical. So, you know, they say that another attack is very likely, not necessarily imminent, but this could really, if there were a fourth attack, heaven forbid that should happen, but I think that would, especially if the fourth attack occurred before the upcoming election on Thursday, that could cause incredible upheaval in Britain.
Mm-hmm. And what is your view of how the British authorities are responding? I know it's interesting that the mayor, and maybe I didn't interpret this correctly an hour ago, but the Londoners will see an upgraded police presence today and over the course
yes.
of the next few days. No reason to be alarmed.
Right.
I suppose they're as afraid of seeing police officers with assault rifles.
No, I don't think it's that. I think the mayor said there's no reason to be alarmed because he thought that seeing armored British police officers might give people the impression that something was absolutely imminent. And he's saying one shouldn't go around thinking that. But of course, the mayor of London is a fairly controversial figure because he has resolutely resisted any claims that Islamism might be connected with these terrorist activities. And in response to that sort of posture, the British Prime Minister Theresa May said that we really had to get off political correctness and acknowledge that Islamist extremism was directly at the root of the ideology of the people who had committed these attacks. And I think she said that, but it's a bit late in the day to say that. She should have said that after the Westminster shooting and a bridge attack back in March.
Mm-hmm. And the thoughts of the UK election this coming Thursday, what's going on with that in relative to these attacks?
No, you know, that's a very good question, Bill. I think the imponderable element is whether, as happens often in the US at times of a crisis imposed on the country by external forces, it might force Britons to stay with their current political establishment and re-elect Theresa May, assuming that she is supposedly the sort of best safeguard of law and order. But there have been times in the past when the British quite unexpectedly went for somebody who was promoting a radically alternate view, not only of foreign policy problems, but even and security problems, but even of economics. And so the remarkable fact about this election in Britain is that after starting with about a 20-point advantage in the opinion polls, Jeremy Corbyn, the opposition leader, has climbed up to win within just a few points of the polling of Theresa May. So he certainly has a chance of winning, but I don't think he probably will in the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, David, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to get your reaction to the president getting out of the Paris Accord and also his trip to Europe and how people have responded to that. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here. I'm talking to Dr. David Aikman, retired professor from Patrick Henry University and foreign policy expert, coming to us from Bray, Ireland via Skype. And David, I'm curious as to what your take is on the U.S. getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Is that bad for America?
Well, it's very hard to tell because if you talk to people who robustly defend President Trump's decision, the argument is that actually the economic advantages that supposedly accrue to those who sign on to the Paris Accord will not actually happen in the U.S. And Americans who support President Trump in this decision say that the U.S. won't have all of those supposed advantages of renewable energy in the economic area. So on the other hand, the people who oppose President Trump's decision say that he's absolutely putting at risk any concerted attempt by the nations of the world to deal with climate change. I frankly think the climate change arguments have been grossly exaggerated in terms of the effect of CO2 gas emissions on the rise of temperatures. I think it's much too early to be categorical about what's going to happen. But nevertheless, President Trump made his decision, and the Europeans responded, as did much of the world, with great dismay and annoyance. In fact, I thought one of the most amusing responses was from French President Macron, who spoke in English on television, and he sort of made a sort of deft reference to the Trump U.S. election campaign promise by saying, "Let's make our planet great again." So there's a certain amount of wry humor that has crept into the situation. But on the whole, I think President Trump in Europe, you know, made a presentable job of emphasizing the importance of major countries to do their share of defense expenditure. I think he was respected by the NATO leaders, although the European community leaders obviously bought into French President Macron's view of the climate accord agreement.
Mm-hmm. David, I want to do a little bit of a postmortem on the U.S., on the president's visit from a Europe standpoint. What did the Europeans think about the visit?
Well, you know, there were a lot of sort of curious sort of footnotes to commentary here. People focused on President Trump's handshake with the French President Macron and the president's supposed sort of macho alpha male strategy of imposing his presence on his interlocutors. And amusingly enough, President Macron, when he met with President Putin of Russia, who was visiting last week, also demonstrated a handshake that seemed to emulate Trump's sort of "I'm the alpha male here" strategy.
Mm-hmm.
People commented on that. I think, you know, the president did pretty well, given the fact that most European leaders seem to have a fairly skeptical view of his wisdom and the wisdom of American policies under him. But I think the jury's still out, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the president's relationship with NATO now?
Well, I think he and the Secretary of State, Tillerson, have made it clear to NATO that this remarkable defense alliance, which has gone on since 1949, has been successful because everybody who has been a member has pulled together to agree to the mutual defense clause of the NATO agreement and has basically kept up with expenditure. The problem is, and this is what President Trump did as candidate Trump, he noted that the Europeans have fallen behind the 2% defense expenditure that NATO had agreed to last year. And I think the Europeans who are, in fact, fulfilling that pledge, which include, of course, the United Kingdom and I think maybe one of the Baltic states, Lithuania, were really very grateful that Trump had said to the rest of the NATO members, hey, guys, it's time to pay up if you want to be part of our club.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, not that I'm saving the best for last, but this North Korea, and they continue to march towards nuclear power. And
right.
Is the U.S., are we running out of time as far as dealing with this menace?
Well, it's very hard to say because to answer the question, are we running out of time, depends on what people's estimates of the time are that it will take North Korea to acquire the ability to heft nuclear weapons on an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could happen, you know, possibly within as little as a year, or some pessimists say that it might be 6 months. I don't think we're running out of time because I think in international politics, especially when you're dealing with a country as unpredictable as North Korea, with such bombastic leadership, the obvious tensions inherent in that. There are all kinds of things that could happen before North Korea is in a definitive position to say, yes, we now have the bomb and we can put it on a ballistic missile. And the West Coast, it's toast for you right now.
Right.
That hasn't happened yet, and I hope it does happen within our foreseeable future. So we're all waiting to see what future circumstances may arise in the North Korean situation.
Mm-hmm. David, we just have about a minute left, and what do you think about the collusion discussions that are going on? And James Comey going to be testifying this week on what he knows?
Well, I think, you know, these hearings, congressional hearings, have gone through ups and downs over the years, not just the last few months of the Comey and then before that the Hillary Clinton escapade. I don't think anything new is going to come from this. I think the people who are convinced that the Trump campaign was in league with Russian leadership will remain convinced, and the skeptics will say there's no evidence that it was. And I don't think the hearings will produce any evidence of collusion to the extent of showing that President Trump won the election because the Russians had somehow helped in some inexplicable but important way.
Mm-hmm. David, always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and happy birthday tomorrow. I will look forward to speaking to you in a couple of weeks. God bless you, and have a wonderful day on your birthday.
Thank you so much, Bill, and blessings to you, too.
Thank you so much. A couple minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back to wrap things up. 1 Thessalonians 5:11 says, therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as, in fact, you are doing. Keep doing it. See you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.